Alright, let's get started. Fine. So, in the last 2 weeks, we discussed the ancient Babylonian cosmology that most of Chazal had, and we discussed how they accepted the newer cosmology, the one initiated by Aristotle and Ptolemy, in which the universe is a sphere, with the Earth being a sphere at the center of it, and the Sun and all the stars and planets moving around the Earth. Okay? Now, I just want to make sure, does everybody see a diagram at the bottom left of the screen and some sources at the top right of the screen? You can just type yes in the chat box. Okay. Fine. So what we're going to be discussing today is we're going to be within the world of the Gaonim and the Rishonim. Right? It's the Rishonim, basically, the 10th to 15th century. And that was this was before Copernicus came on the scene. So everyone's still working within the Aristotelian and Ptolemaic cosmology. 1 second, let me just make the text bigger here. Is that better? Make it bigger still. Hold on a second. There we go, that should be better. Hey Adam, let me just see if I can activate your microphone. Adam, try saying something. Adam, if you click at the bottom of the screen, Adam, you should see a thing saying talk. You want to try holding it down? And there's a padlock button to lock it on. Let's test that and see if that works. Do you see a green bar moving when you're talking? It's grayed out. That's strange. Okay. Alright. So within this period, everybody was working within the idea of the Ptolemaic model. This model of the solar system of the universe was actually first presented by Plato. Aristotle elaborated it a bit more. But it was really Claudius Ptolemy, who really got it going, and he wrote a famous book called The Almagest, in which he presented all the details of this model. So it became known as the Ptolemaic model of the universe. And here you have it in the diagram in the bottom left. You have Earth in the center. Then you have the Moon as being the closest body to us moving around us. Then Mercury, Venus, then the Sun, Mars, Jupiter, Saturn. And beyond those, you have all the other stars further out beyond our solar system. And something called the sphere of the prime mover, the overall sphere, which is basically the edge of the boundary point of the universe beyond that. Right, so this is now a totally standard model that was accepted. If you take a look at the writings, I have the bottom quote here on the screen is from Avraham Bachir Hanasi Savasorda. He was a great Jewish scholar of the earlier 12th century. And he knew a lot of astronomy, and like pretty much everyone in those times, his astronomy came from the Arabs. And he published a book on astronomy called Surat Haaretz V'Tavnit HaShemayim, the form of the earth and the structure of the heavens. And he describes it as follows. You see in the fourth source here. It is clear that this world is placed in the center of the firmament, just like the position of the central point in a sphere. And it does not stray towards any direction. Not east, not west, not north, not south, not up, not down. The truth shall be clarified to you, about which there is no doubt, that the body of earth is placed in the body of the firmament, just like the center point in a sphere. And the air surrounds the earth all around, and the firmament of the moon surrounds the air from all sides, and the other firmaments each surround each other till they reach the firmament that encompasses them all. Now, why was it exactly that they believed that the earth is in the center? I mean, there's a few elements to this model. There's the idea that the earth doesn't move, and there's the idea that it's in the center. So the idea that the earth doesn't move, there's a scriptural source from it, the Pasuk from Tehillim that we see at the top. He established the earth on its foundation, it will never move, which was understood by them to mean it's stationary in the center of the universe. And then we have the idea that the sun moves around the earth, Pasukim in Tehillim that you see after that. The heavens declare the glory of God, in them he has set a tent for the sun. It is like the groom emerging from his bridal canopy, rejoicing like a hero to run his course. He sets forth from one end of the heaven, and his circuit is to the other end, and there is no hiding from his heat. So they have the idea that it's not the sun at the center, right? The sun is moving around the earth. And that's also something that you see in Joshua with the miracle of the sun standing still, right? In the battle of Joshua, the miracle was that the sun stood still, i.e., normally the sun moves. So you have these biblical, scriptural reasons for this model, but there were also some scientific reasons for this model. And there were scientific reasons for people believing that the earth was at the center of the universe. Let's change the picture here to a different one. Here's just an idea of the model, again, with the earth being at the center. Here it shows how everything was conceived of being spheres. That wasn't the picture I was looking for. One second, let me look for one I was looking for. Nope, sorry, not that one either. Is it this one? Yeah. Okay, so here's a scientific reason why they thought that the Earth was at the center. I even saw that new picture that just came up, the images. The universe was conceived of as being like a sphere. You see these stars all around. And, you know, they kept track of which stars were in the sky. And at any given time, you'd only see half the stars in the sky. Right? In other words, people were aware of all the stars that could potentially be seen in the sky, all the different constellations. And on any given night of the year, at any point in history, you'd only ever see half of them. So that implied that we were bang in the middle. Right? That implied that we were bang in the center of the entire universe. Because you'd only ever see half of it. Right? If the Earth was not exactly in the middle, right? If the Earth was not exactly in the middle of the sphere, let's say the Earth was like somewhere over there, then there'd be times when you'd see a lot more stars, constellations, and times when you'd see a lot less constellations. But that's not how it worked. You always saw exactly half the constellations. So that's why it was determined that the Earth must be in the center of the universe. And there were various other scientific proofs, too, that they had. There's another idea that the Earth, things fall to the Earth, right? You drop something, it falls down to the earth. So it was the idea that the earth attracts things. Things fall to the earth. That complicates things. I'm not going to bring that one up now. The idea that the earth doesn't move, though, also made sense. Because, you know, if the earth moved, then if you throw something up in the air, it should come down in a different place. But it doesn't. It comes down in the same place. So there are very scientific reasons for this model. It wasn't just faith in scriptures. There are scientific reasons why people believe that the earth does not move and why the earth must be at the center of the universe. But what I want to do today is really go into discussing not the scientific aspects of it, but the theological aspects of it. In other words, the Rishonim, especially in Sfarad in Spain, so science was a big part of their whole Jewish identity. It was very important to them to study science for various reasons and to incorporate it into Judaism. So, you know, in astronomy, definitely more than any other branch of science, was seen as being the most important branch of science for a Jew to combine with Judaism. So this whole model of the universe was something they incorporated into their theological outlook. So what I want to do today is survey a few different figures from that period and looked at the different ways in which they incorporated this model into their religious outlook. And it also will give us an understanding into why it became so hard for people to then move on to the Copernican system. Now, after this, I want to move on to discussing the reaction in the Jewish world to Copernicanism, and there was a very heated reaction to it. So we have to try and understand why was it that it was met with such opposition. So perhaps part of it is to realize that for the Rishonim, the geocentric worldview, where the Earth is at the stationary center of the universe, wasn't just a scientific model, it was something which became very much part of their religious worldview. Any questions so far? Okie dokie. So let's start with Sadigon. Right, Sadigon from the 10th century. Right, lived in a few places, mainly in Egypt. So he was quite proficient in astronomy. And geocentrism was really a crucial component of his overall religious philosophy in a few different ways. First of all, you know, back then there was the big debate over had the universe always existed or did the universe have a beginning. So the non-Jewish view was that the universe had always existed, and the Jewish view was that the universe had a beginning, and therefore, you know, it involved God. So Sadigan brought the idea that the geocentric universe for, as proof for creation ex nihilo. How did that proof work? Yes, let's let me cut and paste his argument here into it. Hold on a second. Let's replace it with this here. Here we go. Can you hear me again? I'm back. Okay. The first proof of creation ex nihilo is from finitude. That is to say,
can you hear me?
It's clear that the heavens and the earth are finite, and that the earth is at the center and the heavens surround it all around.
Great.
It is necessarily the case that the force in them is finite. Hey, Adam. Yeah, I can hear you. That's great. Okay, so you can speak up if you have any questions. For it cannot be that an infinite force resides in the finite body, for such a thing is rejected by the intellect. And since the force that causes their existence is finite, it is necessarily the case that it has a beginning and an end. So he had this idea that if you want to prove that the universe has not been around forever, then that it's not infinite in time, if you want to prove that the universe is finite in time, so he held that a corollary of that would be that the universe is finite in space. Right, the universe is not infinite in space, it's finite in space. So his proof for that involved the idea that the Earth being in the center. Right, so he wants to show that the Earth is in the center so that he can show that the universe is finite. So how does he show that the Earth is in the center? You know, maybe it's not. So he goes through various arguments that it must be. He shows that the Earth itself... Yeah, Stanley, you had a question. Yeah. Stanley, you have a question? No? Okay, so he goes through various arguments showing that that the Earth itself must be finite because the sun and stars are managed to get all the way around it every day. And the universe must be finite because, you know, we see all the stars moving around the planet and coming around every day. We can see them all. And then he says, well, maybe there's different planets elsewhere in the universe. In other words, maybe, you know, all the stars that we see moving around us, maybe there's a whole other bunch of stars and planets elsewhere, and you know, an infinite range of them. So he says that can't be because everything falls down towards the Earth. So if there were other planets elsewhere, if there are other worlds, they would fall down towards the Earth. So he goes through all these arguments to prove that the universe is finite, right? That it's basically looks like the structure we saw in the picture earlier. Where was that? Yeah, that basically the solid green line represents the edge of the universe. So since the universe is finite in space, it must also be finite in time, which therefore means the universe had a beginning. So that was one way in which he employed this cosmological model for his theology. Now the second way in which he used it was much more famous. In other words, when people think about what was the religious significance of geocentrism, why was the church, for example, so opposed to Copernicus? What is it that people think of? So what it is that people think of is the idea that man is at the center of the universe. Echo from someone's speakers feeding back into the mic. Whoever that might be, you might want to turn your speakers down or use a headset. Okay, so Sadigan was one who used this. Which he wanted to discuss what the purpose of the universe is. So Sadigan introduced this principle that for any given entity, the most important component of that entity is at the center. Let's see how he presents this. Yeah. This works as follows. This is all a quote from Sadigan. Nature and existence place every important thing in the center of those things of lesser importance. We can begin with the least of them and point out that the kernel of grain is centered amongst all the leaves because the kernel is the most important part of it. For the sprouting of the plant and its existence comes from it. Likewise, the seed from which trees grow, if edible, will then it will be in the center of the fruit, such as with a nut. And if it's an inedible kernel, it will be at the center, such as with the date, without regard to the edible part, which will be in the exterior to protect it. Similarly, the yolk of an egg is at the center, because the chick and the young bird begins its development from it. And similarly, a person's heart is in the center of his chest, because it's the soul, the natural source of heat. And the power of vision is in the center of the eye, because vision takes place via it. Alright, so Sadigan is trying to show that this is a universal principle in the natural world. And so then he applies it to the universe also. He says, and when we see this principle applying to so many things, and we also find the earth in the center, and the heavens and spheres surrounding it from all sides, it becomes clear to us, that the earth is the goal of creation. Let me just correct that. Upon further investigation of all its parts, we find that the earth and water are inanimate. You see, he's running into a problem, because if the idea that whatever's the center is the most important, then okay, fine, so the earth is the center of the universe, well, what's at the center of the earth? Now, we're not at the center of the earth, so he has to negate the significance of what's at exactly the center of the earth. So it can't be, you know, the earth itself, because it's inanimate. We find that the animals are incapable of speech. Therefore, there's nothing left other than man, and we thereby clearly know that he is without doubt the intended goal. When we examine scripture, we find that the word of God says so, I have made the earth and I created man upon it. Alright, so Sadi uses the idea, this geocentric model, with the earth being the center of the universe, in order to show that man is the most important part of the universe, that man is the goal of all creation. Now, I know that's regarded as like standard religious belief, but as we're going to see later, there are others shown him who very much argued with this. Okay, now, it's true that you see this idea of the thing at the center being the most important. You do see that idea in the Gemara also, but Sadigan was the one who really adapted it for astronomy and used it to, he incorporated the Ptolemaic model to show that the Earth is the center of the universe, and being the center of the universe, it's the most important part of the universe, and therefore man is the source of creation. Okay, so that's Sadigan. Now,
but right, why is it this is
Bachi ibn Pakuda, the author
this
of
is Bert.
Okay. I know it.
Since God is supposed to be the center of the universe, why is it necessary that man be the center of the universe? Isn't he? The physical center, but since God is not physical, so that God, but God is, we're God-centric, we're not, man-centric.
No. We're God-centric in the sense that we're focused on God. You're saying that according to Sadigan, shouldn't God be at the center? Because he's the goal. But then, the creation, the universe is something that God made. That's the idea. God wasn't made. The universe is something that God made. He's not going to put himself at the center. He's going to put the object of what he makes in the center. Right? Like Adam's saying in the chat window here. Okay? So, Sadigan has a book called Chovis Alvavus, and he has a chapter in it where he discusses a lot of things about nature, and how you should contemplate the wonders of nature in order to see the wisdom of God. So, let's see this paragraph here. How many kinds of wisdom are there that we can meditate upon and manifest in creation? The pillars of wisdom established in creation, although various in kind and nature, are seven in number. The first is an arc of wisdom manifest in the origin and foundations of the world. The position of the world is in the middle, with the water above it, the air above the water, and the fire above all, according to one immutable plan, each keeping its designated place as delineated for it. Concerning the heavens and the earth standing, it is said, forever, O God, your word stands in the heavens, etc., etc. Okay, so here you have the idea that the very neat structure of the universe, with the earth at the center, is a sign of the wisdom of the Creator. Here's a way in which the geocentric model plays a role in his cosmology, but here already it's something that's it's potentially something that can be updated. In other words, we would also look at the universe and say, wow, it's organized in such a wonderful way, it's a sign of a creator. But our way of doing that wouldn't be from the fact that the Earth is in the center. So it's an argument that can be adapted. But you know, the way in which he presents it, incorporated
what's the necessity for the additional proof that human beings are the center of the universe, if it's clear from the actions of God by giving us the Torah and by interacting with us in a direct way, what's the need for Sadi Gaon and these other Rishonim to present additional proofs to that effect?
Excellent question. Well, as we're going to see, there were other Rishonim who disagreed and felt that man was not the goal of creation. Right, so we'll deal with your question when we get to those other views, when we'll see that there are those who actually disagreed with this point. Okay, so that's Rabbeinu Bachya. Now we're going to move on to Shlomo ibn Gavirol, the 11th century. He was a famous poet in Spain. He wrote various poems, and he has one in particular called Keter Malchut, the Royal Crown, which describes the structure of the universe. It's a very, very long poem, but here's the relevant part. Relevant parts. Who shall utter your mighty deeds, for you made a division of the ball of the earth into two, half of dry land, half of water? Right, that reflects the view they had in medieval times, which is that the United States of America, North America, South America does not exist. Right, they knew that there was Europe, Asia, Africa on one side of the earth, and on the other side of the earth is just this gigantic ocean. And you encompass the water with a sphere of air, in which the wind turns and turns on its going and rests in its circuits. And you surrounded the air with a sphere of fire. You encompass the sphere of fire with a sphere of the firmament, which is the moon. You encompass the firmament of the moon with a second sphere, without deviation or infraction, and within it is a star called Mercury. You encompass the second sphere with a third sphere, which is a brightness, as Venus, like a queen amidst a host. You encompass the sphere of this shining one with a fourth sphere, which is the sun that completes its circuit in the perfect year, and so on and so forth. Where's the theological significance here? So, here's where we see Ibn Gavirol, along with Rambam, we'll discuss later. Here's where we see an idea which very much contrasts with Sadi Gaon. We have this idea we mentioned before of the central point being the most important point. There's another idea which can perhaps be seen as contradictory, but not necessarily, that the center of the universe is the least holy part of the universe. Like the idea being that God... See, it's not clear to me if they thought that God was actually spatially located beyond the universe or not. I think they may have. But in any case, it was clear that the furthest part from the world is the most spiritual part. And as you move closer and closer towards Earth, you're moving further away from spirituality and closer to physicality. So let's look at another quote here from his poem. With his hand joining together the tents of the spheres, and with his power fastening together the links of creation, his power touching until the lowly outer edge of creation, the most distant link in the chain. The idea being that, you know, God is beyond the universe, and when he created the universe, he started at the top and worked down, basically, or that's his influence, that's the way the structure is. So the earth is the part that's the most physical. Right, the stars were considered to be quasi-spiritual bodies. So the Earth is the most material, most physical part of the universe, the lowest part of the universe. Right, so whereas for Sadi Gaon, the idea of the center point meant the goal of creation, for Ibn Gavirol, it has the idea of the Earth being the most physical part of the universe, the part that's most furthest away from spirituality. And that's something we'll come back to later when we explore the position of Rambam. Ruben may have posted a link. Haven't got time to click on it now, but I'll certainly take a look at it later. One second. Now let's move on now to Ibn Ezra. Now, Ibn Ezra wrote a lot about astronomy, and he really attacks Sadi Gaon on this. Remember, Sadi Gaon had this whole idea that whatever's in the center of the universe is the most important part of the universe. And he gave lots of different examples, right? He gave an example of apples, of eggs, of the heart of the human being, you know, to prove this governing universal principle that whatever's at the center is the most important part of the universe. So Ibn Ezra really attacks him on that. He starts off by saying that, with a fruit, for example. Firstly, he says, who says an apple? You know, you can't prove universal principles from apples. Secondly, who says that the seed is the goal of the tree? He claims that the fruit, not the seed, is the goal of the tree. I guess he's looking at it from a human perspective, that trees are here for us, and what they're giving us is the fruit, not the seed. He also claims that the chick is formed from the white of an egg, not from the yolk of an egg. No, that would be not exactly correct there. And he also says that what are you saying, that the heart is the center of the human being, and that shows that it's the most important part? That signifies that it's the most important part. He says, no, the brain is the most important part of the human being, not the heart. So he has very sharp words for Sadigan, and he basically completely rejects this whole idea that whatever's at the center of the universe is going to be the most important thing. Right? Now he's not rejecting the idea that the Earth is at the center. He accepts that. But what he rejects is the idea that the Earth is created, that the goal of the entire universe is the Earth. And we'll elaborate on this more later when we come to Rambam. But for Ibn Ezra, it was the idea that the heavens, and by the heavens, we're talking about this area here, right? He held that to be, you know, a quasi-spiritual zone. You know, Ibn Ezra was big into astrology and so on, and he held that you can't say that the heavens around here were created for the earth, because he held that the heavens are more elevated than the earth in a spiritual sense. Right? The heavens and the celestial bodies are quasi-spiritual entities of a much greater significance than the earth, so you can't say that those are created for the earth. So he didn't want to employ the geocentric model to say that what's at the center is the most important, but more similar to Ibn Gavirol, that what's at the center is the lowest idea. Now there's another way in which he used the geocentric model, what's the Hebrew word for something for the center? You want to type it into the chat box? What's the Hebrew word for something being at the center? Okay, so we have toch. Remember I said toch. Toch means in the midst. You don't get dead center with that. Ikar means the fundamental point. Mordechai and Nechama use the word merkaz, right? Merkaz is a word that means center. Now, where in Tanakh does it say the word merkaz? Anyone know where? Where in Tanakh does it say merkaz? The answer is nowhere. It's not a Hebrew word. Merkaz is a word that was taken from Arabic in about the 12th, 13th century. And Ibn Ezra really didn't like that. He didn't like taking this word from the Arabic, because he felt that there was a word in Hebrew that you could employ for that concept. And the word which appears in Tanakh. And it's a word, the word is mutsak. Now, mutsak usually means, I mean, in the Brit, in modern Hebrew, it means to be solid, like to become congealed. But Ibn Ezra uses the word mutsak to mean something like converging together into a single central point. And this is something he mentions in his commentary throughout Tanakh, the idea of this term mutsak, referring to something in the center. here's one example. I'll put it up on the screen of his comments on this. There you go, he says that scripture mentions the heavens and the earth because it's all one sphere, and the heavens are the encircling perimeter, and the earth is the point in the middle, is the mutsak in the middle. Here's another one. Oops. Let's put this here. Yeah, the reason for the world stands firm, is that by way of the pride of God and his strength, it stands among the great sphere like a point in a circle, and it does not move. And since it mentioned the land, which stands with the power of God, and on its mutsak, which is the central point, and is itself the central point of the throne of glory, which is the surrounding perimeter, therefore your throne stands firm from of old. Right, so in several places in his commentary in Tanakh, he's explaining words with this concept of mutsak, which he always stresses is symbolized in the idea of the earth being the mutsak of the universe, the earth being the central point of the universe. Now, let's move on to Rambam. Okay. So, Rambam, at the beginning of the Mishnah Torah, he has a description of the universe. Okay, Marjorie asks a question. She's wondering about Christian influence and the view that the earth is more physical and heaven's more spiritual. Is that an attitude Ibn Ezra shared with the Christian world? Yep, absolutely. Yeah, non-Jews also very much had that idea. That's why, you know, this whole idea of that the Christians rejected Copernicus because they thought it dethroned the earth from its status of being so important. It's not that. It's just the opposite of that. It's true you see the idea with Sadigan, But in the non-Jewish world, it was like we saw from Ibn Gavirel and Ibn Ezra that the contrary, that the earth being in the center shows that it's the least important. Right. Adam's saying, did it come from the Christian world? Did that idea start with them or with us? That's a hard one to say. It's hard to say where these ideas come from. Certainly in Tanakh, you see this idea that Hashem is up there. Right? He's up in Hashem is in Shemayim, and Shemayim is up there. And what are we to make of that? So that's something we'll be getting to probably next week, because Rav Kook is the one who really has a very good approach for dealing with that. Okay, so Rambam, at the beginning of Mishnah Torah, he has a description of the universe. And he says the spheres are that which is called the heavens, and the firmament, and the zvul, and the aravot, different types of firmaments, and they are the nine spheres. Wait, Smara, you lost sound? Everyone have sound? Can you just type a yes if you have sound? Okay, everyone else has got sound, Smara, so it must be something with your computer. Okay. The closest sphere from us is the sphere of the moon, and the ninth sphere is the sphere that revolves every day from east to west, and which encompasses and surrounds everything. All those spheres that surround the world around like a ball, and the earth is suspended in the center. So this is Rambam's view, and you know, there are some people who are very, very into accepting everything that Rambam said. Now, even though Rambam held that even Chazal, the sages of the Talmud, were fallible in science, certainly Rambam would have seen himself as being fallible in science. Nevertheless, there are people today who hold that Rambam was infallible in science. Specifically, I'm thinking of Chabad. It's a very strong belief in Chabad. Therefore, Chabad have a very strong belief in the geocentric universe, based on this paragraph from Rambam. And next week, in 2 weeks' time, we'll be discussing that a little bit further. For now, let's just note that here you have, you know, Rambam describing the geocentric universe, and he's doing so not in a book of science, but in the Mishnah Torah. So what's it doing in the Mishnah Torah? The answer is, for Rambam, learning science was part of Avodas Hashem. It's part of the intellectual perfection. Right? Rambam held that the ultimate goal of man is intellectual perfection, and part of that intellectual perfection is mastering physics and metaphysics. So it was important, from Rambam's point of view, to learn about the structure of the universe. But it doesn't end there. It doesn't end there. Let's go back. So as we mentioned, right, so Sadi Gaon had this idea that the world's at the center, and that points to it being the goal of creation. But Rambam held that you can't say that the earth is the goal of creation. Let's look at this paragraph here. Excuse me. In order to obtain a correct estimate of ourselves, we must reflect on the results of the investigations which have been made into the dimensions and the distances of the spheres and the stars. It has been proved that the distance between the center of the Earth and the outer surface of the sphere of Saturn is a journey of nearly 8,700 solar years. The great distance which has been proved is in fact the least that could be assumed. The distance between the center of the Earth and the surface of the sphere of the fixed stars can by no means be less, but it may possibly be many times as great. As to the thickness of the sphere of the fixed stars, right, the stars were held to be embedded in spheres, it is at least 4 years' journey, as it may be inferred by the measures of the stars contained in the sphere. Right, so Rambam knew that the universe was gigantic. Now consider consider the vastness of the dimensions and the great number of these corporeal beings. If the whole Earth is infinitesimally small in comparison with the sphere of the stars, what is man compared with all these created beings? How could any of us imagine that these things exist for his sake and because of him, and they are instruments for his benefit? Right, an interesting perspective there. Because the Earth is physically tiny compared to the universe, so how could you say that the universe exists for the benefit of the Earth? Now, I'd say, I haven't really analyzed this much, but it certainly sounds a bit odd because, yeah, you can definitely hear that point, but it's exactly what we have a Pasuk in Tanakh to counter, where it says, right, when I behold the heavens, the work of your hands, what is man that you are mindful of him? Right, so in Tanakh it expresses this very idea that, yes, we're minuscule in comparison to the cosmos, and yet you are mindful of him. right, that God does take an interest, take a concern. So I guess, I don't know, I haven't looked into this. Maybe he looked at that as saying that even though we're you might think we're a total nothing, nevertheless Hashem has taken an interest in us. But what he's saying here is that even though, you know, God may take an interest in us, but you can't imagine that the rest of the universe exists for us. And this also relates to the whole idea of geocentrism. In other words, here we say, I'm saying the universe is vast, we're tiny. So how can you say that it's all for us? And in another place, you see Rambam also saying the same idea that in Ibn Gavirol, in Ibn Ezra, that the position of the Earth and the universe indicates that it's not very important. So here we go. He says, the second way in which man is not a this is in a place where he's discussing some ways in which man is a microcosm of the universe, and other ways in which man is not a microcosm of the universe. So he says, the second way in which man is not a microcosm of the universe is that living creatures have their heart in the center of their body. The other parts of their body which are subordinate to it surround it, such that it derives a benefit from them, for they guard and protect it, preventing damage approaching it from outside. But with the in living creatures, you have something important being on the inside, and the thing that and the inferior parts on the outside. But with the universe, the reverse is the case. The superior part encompasses the inferior parts, it being certain that it cannot be affected by the action of any other being. Skip a few lines here. So he's saying there that the inferior part is in the center of the universe, and the exterior part is the superior part. Right, so he says it's different to a living creature, where the inner part is superior to the exterior part. And then I skip a few lines. There is, however, some similarity between the universe and living things in this point. In the body of living things, the organs more distant from the principal organ are of less importance than those nearer to it. And I guess he's saying, you know, the heart is very important, and the organs that are close to the part are still important, but slightly less so. And, you know, as it moves further, your arms are less important, your fingers even less important. Also, in the universe, the nearer the parts are to the center, the more is their lowliness, their solidity, their inertness, their dimness and darkness, because they are further away from the loftiest element, from the source of light and brightness which moves by itself, and the substance of which is the most rarefied and simplest, the celestial sphere. So Rambam has a very interesting idea here. He says that, you know, everywhere you see that the further away you get from the most important thing, there's like a continuum from most important to least important, which continues along the line of distance. But he says that whereas within a living thing, the center is the most important, and as you get further away from the center, you get to less important. With the universe, it's the other way around. The most important part of the universe is the outer edge of the universe, and as you go further away from the outer edge, you get to the least lowliest part of the universe, which is the Earth at the center. Alright, so who was it who asked earlier about this? According to Rambam, you know, God definitely takes an interest in us. He gave us the Torah, which is an opportunity to perfect ourselves, perfect our intellect. But Rambam held that the sun, the stars, and so on, the planets are intelligent beings, and he held that they were a higher order than us. A higher order of existence than us. So this geological system, no, it's not geological. Sorry, this geocentric model, the Ptolemaic cosmology, for Rambam it was very much a part of his whole religious outlook. It expressed the idea that these you know, we're not just looking at a physical structure of the universe, we're looking at a spiritual physical structure of the universe. The idea being that these stars are intelligent beings.
This is Bert again. Since the purpose of man is the Torah, we have the Torah, you know, so how could anything be greater than we are?
Hi, Bert. So, you know, Rambam wasn't controversial for nothing. According to Rambam, Torah is really, the whole point of Torah is a means to an end. Torah is meant to perfect us intellectually. And it's all the mitzvahs that we do are designed to improve our intellect, to make us be able to, for Rambam, the ultimate goal of creation is to have a certain intellectual connection with God. And Rambam held that the stars and the planets and so on, well, they've already got that, or they are a lot closer to it than we are. So they don't need to do all these mitzvahs like Talis and Tefillin and so on, because they're already above and beyond that. I know, it sounds shocking, huh? They didn't burn his books for nothing.
You're in good company.
If you want to learn more about Rambam's view, you should read the writings of, like, Menachem Kalner and so on. Okay. Alright, Psachy here. What's Psachy's question? Lowly equals less important. Where does that assumption come from? What do you mean lowly? You mean physically lowly? What do you mean? Rambam held, look how Rambam presents it, that the lowliness and solidity of physicality, Rambam sees, you know, physicality as being in opposition to spirituality. Right? So the earth is certainly a very physical, material body. Right? Now Rambam didn't conceive of the moon as being a lump of rock. Right? The moon is ethereal, spiritual body. Now, the earth is the most physical part of the universe, which signifies that it's furthest from spirituality.
We're going back and forth in this conversation regarding, the importance, the lack of importance of the Earth as it's being in the center of the universe. How can we discern whether or not the Rishonim and the different sources we're looking at are discussing things from a physical perspective, from a spiritual perspective? It's very easy to say that the Rambam is saying that from a spiritual perspective, you know, the Earth is the lowest spiritually, and therefore we have the potential to grow the most in these types of ideas. Yeah. How do we
know who's speaking about physically also? Is that your question? Well, we know we saw it in the Mishnah Torah.
I'm not asking.
Well, in the Mishnah Torah, we know
whether or not, you know, we're saying.
You're saying that how do we know that even there he wasn't speaking spiritually?
Go ahead.
I mean, ultimately, this is the kind of thing that, you know, if you deter. Oh. Your sound is very intermittent. Hey, your sound cuts in and out. Maybe you want to, if you write the question in the chat box, it might actually be easier. Just a second, everyone. I just want to field this question. You know what, type the question, and then I'll try and come back to it soon, okay? For now, I'm going to move on to the final person we'll be discussing today, which is, possibly the final, which is Ralbag Ghassanides. Right, he was not only an outstanding Torah scholar, also excelled in philosophy, mathematics, astronomy. Now, he had a couple of critiques of the geocentric model that eventually was going to be answered by Copernicus. But even though he had a couple of critiques of Ptolemy's model, of the geocentric model, he stuck with it. Now, you know, he was aware of the heliocentric model. Copernicus wasn't the first person to come up with the idea of the Earth moving around the Sun. It was Aristarchus in 270 BCE. He'd already proposed a heliocentric model of the universe. It was known that there was such an idea as a heliocentric model. So Ralbag said that even though there's some difficulties with the geocentric model, but he stuck with it. He rejected the heliocentric model. And he has a very, very interesting way in which he employs the whole geocentric model into his cosmology, into his theology, sorry. He uses it to explain the mitzvah of saying Shema in the morning and at night. He says that God has commanded us to say Shema twice daily, when we go to sleep and when we wake up. For in it is the remembrance of the commandments we've mentioned, which are the cornerstones of the Torah. However, regarding the recitation being done at these times, you know, why do you have to say Shema in the morning and night? Because these times demonstrate that the spheres possess motion. And one then studies the moving and the stationary stars. And there's two types of stars. There's the moving stars and the stationary stars. What are the moving stars? We call them by their name now. What do we call the moving stars today? Planets. No, planets. Moving stars are the planets. They're the ones that move around all over the sky, whereas the stars, which are obviously much further away, stay in pretty much the same place. For one sees the moving stars becoming more distant than the stationary stars that were they were closer to, or the reverse. Alternatively, one can study the sun at sunrise, and one will see that the place of its dawning in one day is different from the place of its dawning in a different day. And this shows that the sun moves and not the earth, as some of the ancients thought. And this explains how these times demonstrate that the spheres possess changing movements and therefore require a prior mover. And this will necessarily bring one to the belief that there is one God who arranged all these movements which together establish this lowly existence. So it's really just in passing that Rambam mentions this idea that the sun's movement disproves the geological worldview. But he saw this whole cosmology idea as showing a creator. And when he contemplates the motions of the suns and the stars and the planets, he sees the idea of God. Now, this is something that Rambam speaks about more. That Rambam, you know, as we mentioned, thought that the stars were intelligent beings, and part of the idea of that is that how they move around. You know, how can they move around in different motions? Normally, when things move around, it's because that they're animate, because they're alive. So that's why Rambam thought that the stars possess intelligences. Rambam presents it slightly differently here. The idea being that, you know, if sunrise and sunset, was he contemplate all the motions of the sun and the stars and so on, and that's the kind of thing that brings you to recognition of God, which is what Shema is all about. Now, so what's interesting is that so you have geocentrism playing a role in Rauberg's theology, but Rauberg's theology played a role in Galileo's heliocentrism. Right? You know, Galileo got into a spot of bother over his whole heliocentric worldview, and one of the main charges against him was that how can you say that the Earth goes around the sun and that the sun is stationary when in the story of Yoshua, the whole miracle was that the sun stopped. The sun stood still. In other words, that ordinarily the sun moves. So the claim was that Galileo was a heretic for going against what happens in the book of Joshua. So Galileo wrote a letter to the Grand Duchess Christina in which he invoked Rauberg to help him. It's as follows. It's a letter from Galileo. Even if we resolve to condemn or admit physical propositions according to scriptural passages uniformly expounded in the same sense by the fathers, I still fail to see how that rule can apply in the present case, inasmuch as diverse expositions of the same passage occur amongst the fathers. So he starts off by saying that you can't call somebody a kofar, a heretic, for going against the book of Joshua when there's a lot of dispute as to what's going on exactly in those verses. What is more, among the Jewish authors endorsed by Josephus, some, i.e. Rauberg, held that the sun did not really stand still, but that it merely appeared to do so by reason of the shortness of the time by during which the Israelites administered the feet to their enemies. Rauberg held that the whole idea of the sun standing still does not literally mean that the sun stopped moving. It just means that they won the war so quickly it was as though the sun stood still. Now, the reason why he said this was nothing to do with him having a heliocentric worldview. Right? He didn't. He rejected the heliocentric model. It was because he was very against miracles. Like Rambam, like the whole rationalist approach, he did not like the idea of miracles. He felt that, you know, God designed the universe so well, he shouldn't have to interfere with it in order to make it do what he wants. So Rauberg was very against the idea of miracles, and therefore he explained that this whole idea in the book of Joshua was doesn't really mean that the sun stopped. So Galileo made use of him here in order to try and defend himself. Of course, it didn't really help very much. So we'll end with one final person, which is Yitzhak Yisraeli Ben Yosef, who was a student of the Rosh, and he wrote a book in astronomy called Yesod Olam. And he, you know, again, this discusses how the Earth is at the center of the universe. And he discusses several theories as to why exactly is the Earth at the center of the universe, from a scientific point of view. So he discusses that maybe it's recoiling from the spiritual stars on all sides, because it, you know, it can't deal with their exaltedness, and it's recoiling from them equally, and that ends up in the middle. Or that the stars on all sides are kind of disgusted with the Earth, and therefore they repel it, right? like the way two like poles of a magnet repel each other. So the idea that there's a natural repulsion between spirituality and physicality. So because, you know, around the universe on all sides is the stars, which are spiritual bodies, and they're pushing away at us, so they end up we end up being in the center. So he discusses all these competing theories that people had in those days as to why the Earth was in the center, and he rejects them all. He says, really, the reason why the Earth is in the center of the universe is as follows. The truth about which there is no doubt is that the place which is befitting for it, according to the benefit to the world and its good, is that it should be affixed in the center, everything being at rest and at peace there. That if the Earth was moving, that would be problematic. It wouldn't be such a great idea. I guess he had the idea that if it was moving, things would be falling around all over the place. And therefore, it's just good. It's part of the goodness of the Creator that the Earth is stationary at the center of the universe. So just as they said in Bereshit Rabbah, why is it called Aretz? Why is it the world called Aretz? As it runs to fulfill the will of its Maker. So the Earth is doing exactly what Hashem wants. And Hashem wanted the Earth to be, world to be happy and content and tranquil, and therefore the Earth stays still at the center of the universe. And what the great irony here is that this Midrash is exactly what others would later employ to back up the heliocentric model. Because they say here in this Midrash you have the idea of the Earth running to fulfill the will of its Maker, which implies that the Earth moves. So this exact same Midrash, which is employed by Yitzhak Yisraeli to show that the Earth is stationary at the center of the universe, it was employed by others to show that the Earth moves. So, let's just recap. We've seen that the whole geocentric model, it wasn't just a matter of science for them. It was something which they incorporated into their theology. Right? For Sadiagon, it was important in proving that the universe had a beginning and in proving that the man is the goal of creation. Whereas for Rambam and Ibn Gavil, it was the opposite. It was to show that the man is the not the goal of creation. That the goal of creation cannot be man because it's the lowest point of the universe. Now, for Rabbeinu Bachya, it shows the creative wisdom of God. Now, Ibn Ezra used it to explain many different pesukim. Ralbag used it in part of his proof of a prime mover. Rambam also used it as part of the knowledge that a Jew has to have in order to perfect his intellect. So we've seen many different ways in which geocentrism was really, they really tried to incorporate it into their religion. So this will give us an insight into why it was very hard for them to be a transition towards accepting the Copernican model. And beginning next week, we'll start discussing the Copernican revolution and look at, which people were okay with the Copernican revolution, which people rejected it, and the even more interesting question, which is why did some reject it, and how did some accept it? So that's what we'll be doing next week. Again, if anyone wants to, as usual, if anyone wants the sources that I mentioned, drop me an email, and I will email you the sources. Right, you can email my email. Those who joined here for the first time is zoorabbi@zootorah.com. Drop me an email, I can send you all the sources that I discussed today. Eventually, all this, I will be publishing all this material in a book. I've all got it, it's all pretty much written already. I'm not sure exactly when that will be. Any questions? The book's title will probably be Shaking the Heavens. Rabbinic responses to astronomical challenges of Ptolemy and Copernicus. Thank you.